Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. Retirees aren't the only people boosting the population in Sussex County. There's also an influx of younger workers.
They've been seeing this broadly since before the pandemic, and they report this as part of a statewide movement in which young people are moving to Delaware because of the lower costs and what they see as the better quality of life.
Contributor John Hurdle explains who these younger workers are and why they're moving to Sussex. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also look at what to expect from the upcoming holiday shopping season. Arts Playlist previews the Delaware Symphony's holiday concerts. And History Matters tells us how the home of a former U.S. senator has been transformed into a museum and conference center. It's all next on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a first state of mind. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. When people discuss the growing population in Sussex County, the focus is often on retirees. But the county is also seeing younger workers flock to the area, a trend documented by a new survey by Site Selection Magazine, a national publication that annually ranks states, cities, and counties for their attractiveness to business. This week, Delaware Public Media contributor John Hurdle dives into this trend and the reasons behind it, and he joined me earlier this week to discuss what he learned. So, John, let's start with the numbers. Retirees are still a growing demographic, for sure, but what kind of growth is Sussex seeing with these younger people?
Well, according to the latest data from the U.S. Census Bureau, almost 5,000 people between the ages of 25 and 44 moved into Sussex County from between 2020 and 2024. And that's driving most of the of Delaware's growth in that sector of the population. Even though Newcastle County had a slightly bigger overall number, it's showing us a lower growth rate. That information was reported by a national publication called Site Selection Magazine, and those findings were presented to the business community at a conference at Delaware Tech in October.
So many of the younger people coming in are providing services to that older retiree demographic. Can you tell us a little bit more about how that translates to job growth in Sussex and how that job growth compares to what we're seeing elsewhere in Delaware?
The best number that we have on job growth is that from the Delaware Department of Labor. And they said in their 2024 economic report that Sussex County gained about 2,500 jobs last year. And that translates into a percentage gain of about 2.7%, which is more than three times higher than Kent County, and in fact, four times higher than the 0.6 reported for Newcastle County. We should also note that Sussex was the only county to have no job losses in any employment category last year, and that is according to the state survey.
Very interesting numbers-wise, probably unexpected to many people. But it's not just the jobs that are spurring younger people to move to Sussex County. Can you tell us about some of the other factors that seem to be making it attractive for this younger demographic to make Sussex County home?
Well, what I'm hearing from the economic development people in Sussex County and others the economic development people statewide, is that that lower property taxes are a significant driver for this increase in younger workers in Sussex County. Some people in that category are moving from out of state, where they would have to pay a higher rate of property taxes, and so that's one of the things that is driving them. And there's also, of course, the fact that there's no sales tax in Delaware.
So it's some economic factors that are pushing people this way, but not all the factors are economic. There was a spike in movement during COVID, fueled, it appears, by the ability to work remotely. Then I guess that remote factor is playing a role here.
Oh, indeed it is. Remote working is a significant factor for workers in Sussex County and across the state. According to WalletHub is a personal finance organization. They did a survey earlier this year and found that 13% of Delaware workers work remotely, and that virtually all Delaware workers have the capacity to work remotely because of lower internet costs versus most other states, and good access to broadband. And so those things together gave Delaware as a whole the number one spot in a national ranking of states that are suitable for remote working. And because of its somewhat lower costs than in many other parts of the Mid-Atlantic and the Northeast, remote workers can effectively give themselves a raise by moving to Sussex County. They have lower costs there, and of course they can still do their jobs, albeit from 100 miles away or 200 miles away or whatever it might be.
And they're proximate enough to major centers like Philadelphia, Washington, D.C., Baltimore, New York, that if that's a place they need to be for work at some point, it's not that far away if they're working remotely most of the time.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, the supporters, the boosters of Sussex County as a place to live and work, do say that in addition to its relatively low costs, it is also centrally located to those places that you just mentioned, so that it's not like anybody who moves to Sussex County is sort of marooning him or herself out in the wilderness.
There's also a reason that's connected to the high number of retirees that's drawing people here. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, indeed. I spoke with Andrew Harton. He's the Director of Economic Development for Sussex County. And one of the factors that he said was causing this influx of young people is that some of them, anyway, have been used to taking vacations in Sussex County, and they've and when they were children, when they were younger, presumably they went with their parents, and now the parents have retired to Sussex County, and that, of course, that has encouraged the young people to move there themselves. Of course, they're also drawn by the increasing economic opportunities there, and so you've got two separate generations who are taking up residence in Sussex County. And what Harton was telling me is that he knows of cases when the young workers come to have their own families, then they use their own parents as a source of childcare, which, by the way, as everybody knows, is very expensive and hard to find.
So another way maybe to give yourself a raise by the circumstance you put yourself in. You also, John, talked to some people at the Delaware Prosperity Partnership, Delaware's public-private economic development entity. What did they have to say about this trend?
Well, they said that they've been seeing this broadly since before the pandemic, perhaps anecdotally, they report this as part of a statewide movement in which young people are moving to Delaware because of the lower costs and what they see as the better quality of life. What is probably a telling example here, during my reporting of this story, I heard from a young woman, 23-year-old woman, who had frequently visited her parents who had moved to Sussex County, and then she and her boyfriend moved to the county about during the summer of this year, set up their own business, which is now a regular bus service, the county's first regular shuttle service between Lewis and Philadelphia International Airport, this young woman was actually originally from New York City, and she says that not only has she found she and her boyfriend have found economic opportunities in Sussex County, but they're also very much enjoying the quality of life and the good beaches, and of course she enjoys being near her parents. So I think it's from that's an example of what she sees as a win-win-win.
But this doesn't necessarily mean Delaware is going to draw more employers to the state. There is a little bit of a difference between drawing some of these workers and maybe drawing a company that will hire workers.
Well, that seems to be the suggestion. I mean, going back to the survey by Site Selection magazine, it found that Delaware ranked a lowly 41st out of 50 states for an overall business climate. That judgment was made on a series of 10 attributes that makes up for a favorable business climate. And those attributes included utilities, regulation, transportation, workforce skills, and quality of life. Now clearly, Delaware in general and Sussex County specifically does not rank low on all of those things, but overall, its rankings were pretty far down the heap. So it's not necessarily these attributes don't necessarily mean that there's going to be that more companies are going to be moving there, presumably until some of those factors get addressed.
So as we wrap this up, you talk to a variety of people. From those people, is this a trend that Sussex seeing this growth with younger workers, something that's likely to continue at least in the short term? I mean, that we are seeing kind of growing concerns about development, traffic, affordable housing, infrastructure in Sussex. Is the potential that those things could erode this trend over time, that there may be a ceiling somewhere?
Well, I guess you would have to say that inevitably growing demand will eventually push up prices. I mean, housing would be one example. I mean, maybe there would be increased traffic congestion. There would be more development of the natural sites that are seen as being, an important part of Sussex County's attraction for young people. But for the moment, I think it sounds like all the stars are in alignment, and that for the time being, it's an attractive place for younger workers.
Thanks to contributor John Hurdle for his time this week. You can find John's piece on the growing number of younger workers landing in Sussex County right now at DelawarePublic.org. And stay with us. The holiday shopping season is upon us, and we take a look at what to expect as you try to get what's on your list this year. That's next on The Green here on Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. With Thanksgiving next week, holiday shopping kicks into gear for retailers and consumers. Retailers hope people are ready to spend on gifts this year, while shoppers are seeking the trendiest items and best deals. What factors could play a role in what gifts and how many land under the tree? Each year, we look to contributor Eileen Dalabrida to answer that question. Her preview of what retailers and shoppers can expect is available right now at DelawarePublic.org. And she joined me earlier this week to offer her insights on this year's holiday trends. So let's start with the basics, Eileen. What's the overall forecast for the holiday shopping season from the experts who track these things?
Well, the National Retail Federation, which is the big trade group for retailers, they're going to predict that holiday sales will be up about 4%, and that means that they will surpass that $1 trillion threshold for the very first time. But a few other trackers, PwC and Deloitte, both predict that spending will be down a little bit this year due to kind of a softening job market and just concerns about the economy.
I was going to say, so in a lot of ways, it's like the amount of dollar spent is going to go up, but people may be spending less. They're just spending more on fewer items.
Yes. And that's one thing that makes gift cards especially attractive, because that $100 gift card still costs $100, even though the person who receives it might not be able to get as many things for it.
So one thing we've heard, Eileen, about all year long is the potential impact of tariffs on prices. Do we see any of that reflected in holiday gift prices? And if so, are there some areas that are more affected than others by tariffs?
Yes. And as a matter of fact, 85% of consumers expect to pay higher prices simply because of tariffs. Toys, what's Christmas without toys? And tariffs will add at least 10% to the price of toys. And also, it means that inventory might not be as abundant as we've seen in previous years. So if you're shopping for toys and you see what you want, it might not be a good idea to wait around for the price to go down. Just grab it while it's there. Other categories that really rely a lot on imports are clothes and electronics. So expect to pay more for them as well.
We know, of course, inflation and the recent government shutdown haven't really helped build consumer confidence. You mentioned the softening job market a little bit earlier as well. How much of a worry is that for retailers that there's just kind of not a lot of consumer confidence out there? And how is this affecting what consumers are doing?
Well, a lot of consumers are holding off on shopping and holding back on spending simply because so many things cost more. And even folks with secure jobs are impacted by hearing about thousands of government workers being laid off. So that the result of that is that 33% of shoppers, one third of consumers, have yet to make a purchase and do not plan to start until Black Friday.
So really, it is a very cautious approach from consumers, which I'm sure makes retailers a little bit more nervous. They'd like to have that money already in the bank rather than wait for that last few weeks for people to shop.
They've been trying.
You also note in your story that there's a bit of a split between how young people are approaching holiday spending versus older shoppers. What does that look like?
Well, Gen Z, the oldest of whom are 28, are really cutting back on their holiday spending. 23%, far more than any other age group. And a lot of Gen Z young people, they are contending with a tighter job market, and a lot of them don't have much in savings. So they're really sensitive to price increases, while millennials, Gen Xers, and baby boomers, they'll spend as much as they did before. And some will even spend a little more.
We always take a few minutes to talk about online sales versus brick and mortar shopping. Cyber Monday clearly has become a really big thing over the years. How do online sales look this year? And where does something like AI fit in now with people going online and doing their shopping?
Well, online shopping continues to gain momentum, and more than half of consumers now plan to make most of their purchases online, and a lot of them are turning to AI for guidance. Here's an example. If you ask AI Mode, which is a Google search feature, for help, you'll get curated suggestions that give you the prices, reviews of the products, and where they're sold. And it really is very specific, such as cozy sweaters for hiking in blue and white stripes. So ask exactly what you want for, and you'll find out where to get it and how much it costs.
On the brick and mortar side as well, there's, of course, always the small local businesses that are trying to make the most of the holiday season, starting with Small Business Saturday next week. Are there some good reasons to check out those small local shops near you, instead of perhaps relying on online or the big box stores?
This truly is a great time to support your local retailer. And buying local is a meaningful and conscious choice for many consumers. And indie merchants are really stepping up to make themselves more accessible for shoppers. I spoke with Molly Molesky, who is the owner of Oh So Molly, a boutique in Trolley Square in Wilmington. And she is opening on Sundays, a day that she's usually closed, throughout December. So shoppers have more time to buy gifts. And she's also promoting heavily on TikTok and Instagram, posting every day to let people know she's there and encouraging them to come visit.
And honestly, some of those local merchants can be better than AI if you're looking for gift ideas.
There's nothing like the personal touch.
So, how about the big chain stores, Eileen? Are they still expecting to be busy? Are they hiring extra staff as they have often done in the past to handle the holiday shopping load?
They are hiring extra help, but not as many people as they have in previous years. This year, retailers have the upper hand. They don't have to offer big incentives like higher wages or signing bonuses. Whereas, in contrast, Amazon offered up to $3,000 in signing bonuses in 2023, and Macy's was paying their employees $500 to recruit extra help. None of that this year. There's a lot of people who are looking for temp jobs, and also the stores aren't open for all those expanded hours the way they have been in previous years. Remember when Macy's was open 24 hours a day? This year, maybe an extra hour. Maybe opening earlier in the morning or staying open till 9 o'clock at night, not 11, not midnight.
Right. Very different atmosphere. One thing we haven't talked about in the past is holiday decorations. And I'm curious, what do prices look like there, specifically when it comes to, that age-old debate of a real tree versus an artificial tree?
Well, you're going to pay more for the decorations you put on the tree, whether it's an artificial tree or a real tree. The cost of decorations is up between 20% to 20% just because they're imported. Almost all of them are imported. So here's the thing about an artificial tree. Buy one and you don't have to buy another one for years. So that kind of takes you out of the market for a while. A fresh tree is an annual expenditure. With that said, there's something extra Christmassy about those real trees, that scent of pine wafting through the house, and later the hum of the vacuum sweeping up the needles. So lots of folks still cut their own tree or head to the local lot to pick out the perfect tree. And if you need a real tree in a hurry, Amazon will deliver a fresh 6-foot fir to your door, but you'll have to pay for that convenience. The price tag is $200.
Yeah, I guess if you're looking for an artificial tree this year, maybe with the tariffs and it being perhaps imported, it would be more expensive than a real tree. But over time, the artificial tree will kind of pay for itself by not having to buy a real tree every year. Interesting dynamic. We've also noted in recent years the timing of the holiday shopping season has shifted. We see the sales and the store decorations much earlier. You mentioned earlier that people are kind of holding off on buying. Is there a benefit to just waiting a little bit? You said maybe for some items there wouldn't be, but does procrastinating help in some items, waiting for maybe a bigger sale later?
Well, a lot of that depends on how the shopping season goes,
Mm-hmm.
but I do think that that inventory could be a problem this year, and there's not a great benefit to procrastinating at this stage of the game. A lot of big retailers, Target, Walmart, they've already been promoting their holiday pricing. So I think that there really are going to be some great deals on Black Friday. But otherwise, if you see it, you like it, and the price is reasonably right, grab it.
Thanks to contributor Eileen Dalabrida for joining us on The Green this week. A reminder, her piece on the holiday shopping season is available right now at DelawarePublic.org. Up next, Arts Playlist, and a look ahead to the Delaware Symphony Orchestra's holiday concert offerings this year. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. The Delaware Symphony Orchestra and its new music director, Michelle DeRusso, are getting ready for the holiday season, presenting a pair of concerts in the coming weeks. The first of those concerts is a new offering for the symphony, a family-friendly matinee concert at the Grand in late November. They'll follow that with Holidays at the Hotel early next month. On this edition of Arts Playlist, Delaware Public Media's Martin Matheny speaks with Michelle DeRusso to learn more about these concerts.
Before we get into talking about the upcoming holiday concerts, I kind of want to check in. It was just about a month ago that you took the podium for the first time as the orchestra's music director. How's everything going?
It's great. I'm really enjoying getting to know the orchestra better, you know, because one thing is the impression you get when you're guest conducting or during the audition, where all both parties are looking for very specific things. But I feel like now that we have time to really get to know each other, it's been really, really amazing. And I'm just so impressed by the musicianship and how well predisposed they are, you know, to try new things, to work really hard and to really do what I'm asking. So it's been great.
I wonder what you're hearing from audiences after the first few concerts.
Oh, really great feedback, actually. They're very excited. They really like the music. So that's great to know as we are planning for next season and also considering what pieces we should put in there, what composers maybe the audience would like to hear, and also getting input from the orchestra of pieces that maybe they haven't, you know, performed or played in a long time, and we want to bring those back as well. So the first concert, you know, everybody loved the Piano Concerto, the Rachmaninoff number 3. It's just an amazing piece, but they love the Tchaikovsky and they love the new piece as well. So I was surprised they liked all of it, because sometimes they're like, oh, my favorite was, you know, Tchaikovsky or whatever. But in this past week, we had more contemporary repertoire on the first half, and then we had Beethoven's Eroica at the very end. And so I was also trying to gauge how the audience will react to this new repertoire, and I was like, it was amazing that they loved the new repertoire actually more than the Beethoven. Some of them, they were like, oh, I love the first piece and the concerto. So it's also for me good to get that feedback, and I've been asking for that feedback because I need to get to know them better, and maybe what, you know, would work somewhere else in the country is very different in Delaware. So we have to be very aware and very tuned into what our community and our audience is like.
Well, let's talk about holiday concerts. There are two upcoming, and I guess let's start with the first, the Jingle Bell Jamboree. What's on the program?
Yeah, so, you know, this is a new format we're trying, and it's targeted to everyone, but especially families that maybe feel that a longer concert is not the right format for them, or the time of the day at night is not good for them. So that's why it's a matinee concert. There's no intermission. It's just 1.5 hours and done. So, you know, you just need to sit there once and not, you know, try to get your kids from the restroom back into the hall, which that can be tricky. And I thought about this program in a way that it could be really engaging with the audience. So it's very short pieces. It's the holiday classics. So we have, you know, it's the most wonderful time of the year. Then we have this medley that is called Around the World at Christmas Time that I really, really like, because it brings cultures from different countries and different, I would say, traditions or melodies from different countries all around the world. That's why it's titled like this, because, you know, the holidays, everybody celebrates it differently. So I wanted to think of that as well. Then, of course, we're performing some Nutcracker, because, you know, the holidays are not the holidays without some Nutcracker, and I love the music. And then we have a sing-along, so that there's going to be some audience participation. They're going to have the lyrics on the program so they can sing with us with the orchestra at the very end. And also we have our feature of the concert, which is the Wilmington Children's Chorus. We've been already rehearsing with them. They're going to be performing with the orchestra. They're super excited. They've been already preparing a lot, and they're wonderful. I cannot emphasize enough how amazing they are. And, you know, it's such a great opportunity for children to be able to perform with an orchestra. So I think there's going to be a little bit of everything.
And then just about a week and a half after that, you've got Holidays at the Hotel, at the Hotel DuPont, with a special guest as well. So tell me a little bit more about that.
Yeah, that concert we've been doing every year since before I got here, of course. The other one is a new format we're trying, but we know that people love the DuPont Hotel. I know I do. It's such a beautiful historic place. And it's also a celebration, maybe more for grown-ups. And we have Clara Osowski, our mezzo-soprano, who will be joining us for the evening. We're going to have some selections from Messiah, Bach, from the Christmas Oratorio. But we have other pieces that will feature the orchestra as well. We have Mother and Child by Still. We have the Raspighi, the Citico Botticelliano. And there'll be an encore at the very end. So please don't leave right away. There's one more surprise at the very, very end. Clara's amazing. I haven't worked with her, but we've been putting the program together. She's such an amazing collaborator and artist. So we're really excited about that. And we have also commissioned an arrangement for her by Chris LaRosa for this particular concert so that it would fit our instrumentation and it would just really make her shine. And, you know, we can put all the pieces that we wanted in this program without having restrictions. So, yeah, I would say two very different programs, one more for families, another one more for grownups, a bit more introspective in some ways. But I think that good variety of options, whatever, however you want to celebrate the holidays, right?
You know, there's so much holiday music out there. I wonder what goes into taking all of the repertoire that's out there and figuring out how to fit that into an hour or an hour and a half, and sort of what priorities you bring into programming these concerts.
Yeah, that's a really great point, because indeed there is so much music out there. For me, I think of my audience and the tunes and the music that they will mostly be familiar with, while balancing with things that maybe they've never heard before. So I like to have a good mix of both. And this is going to sound a bit selfish, but I also include my favorite ones because I get to choose, right? So, and not only because of that, but because I think that if the music I'm performing I feel passionate about and I really like, then that translates to the audience and how they'll react to it, right? So, for example, in the first concert, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, I know that's a piece that any kid will know, right? So that's a good way for them, if they are there, to know the piece and be like, oh, I know that one, right? Then, you know, the medley might be new to some of them. Carol of the Bells, it's honestly my favorite. I really, really love it. That canon is just beautiful. Then maybe one that maybe some of might not know is Prokofiev Troika, which it is another one that is my favorite. The music is amazing. It's just has the sly bells. It's just a great piece that I love. Then, you know, another one that maybe they might know, Winter Wonderland, right? And then Nutcracker. So I tried to balance it out a little bit. With the other concert, you know, everybody knows Messiah, or maybe some selections from the Christmas Oratorio. There still is a new piece, but it's just such a beautiful piece. Then the Raspighi might be new to some of them. So I tried to, I don't want to alienate the audience. I want them to be excited about coming to our concert, because maybe they know some of the pieces and they want to hear maybe just one piece of all the other ones I selected for the program. But if that gets them to come and to listen to new music, then my mission is done, you know, and maybe they'll be like, oh my gosh, look, all of that new music that I didn't know. And, you know, when you think about it, when we, let's say your favorite artist releases an album, right? You don't know all the pieces. You have a moment of getting to know this new music, of getting familiar with it, and of you having to go with an open mind, right, of what you're going to listen to. So I think we should still have that idea and that attitude when you come to a classical concert. Of course, you want to hear the music you know, but you also need to go, you know, with an open mind, with curiosity, to see what you might find out that it's new, and then suddenly you love as well. So
when we last spoke this summer, we talked about community outreach, and that's something I know you're really passionate about. And I wonder if you can talk a little bit about how concerts like the Jingle Bell Jamboree concert, especially, what role do those play in the overall job of making the symphony a bigger part of the community?
Yeah, I mean, that's the whole point of that concert, is to start to try new formats and for a different type of audience, to see if that's what they like and they enjoy, and also understand that it takes time to build this as well. So maybe the first time not everyone will hear about it, but then we do it next year and it'll become like a tradition for the symphony for this particular audience, right? But this is just the beginning. I'm thinking for next season how we can have other types of concerts that are also earlier in the day, because it's not just families. Maybe some older people don't want to go out at night, right? And so we want to take into account that the communities are very diverse and they want to hear different things in different formats in different places. So that's what we are considering when we think about community outreach. And, you know, it's about getting to our audience. And I think that's part of me too, of talking to our audience and getting to know them better. And so the past two concerts, I've been going out at the very end as quickly as I can after saying thank you to the musicians, because I do want to hear what they have to say. I want to hear if they like the pieces. I want to hear if they had a good time. And I'm interested in knowing the feedback. Of course, we can't, you know, do everything everyone says, but it's good to have these inputs because then we know what's the general idea of what they need, what our audiences and community needs, and start targeting to their needs.
Thanks to Delaware Symphony Orchestra Music Director Michelle DeRusso and our Martin Matheny for joining us on Arts Playlist. The Delaware Symphony Orchestra presents Jingle Bell Jamboree on Sunday, November 30th at the Grand in Wilmington, followed by Holidays at the Hotel DuPont on December 9th. Tickets and more information are available at DelawareSymphony.org. And we wrap up the Green next with History Matters, where we learn how Delaware Tech is keeping a former U.S. Senator's legacy alive at a new facility in Sussex County. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. Delaware Tech recently celebrated the opening of the John and Elsie Williams House Museum and Conference Center. The facility encompasses several rooms in the Williams' former home, which the family first built in Millsboro in 1927. The Williams' daughter, Blanche Baker, wanted the home to honor the accomplishments of her parents, former Delaware U.S. Senator John Williams, who was often lauded for his nonpartisan approach to politics, and his wife, Elsie, who contributed to that approach by building social connections in Washington that fostered across-the-aisle relationships. In this edition of History Matters, Delaware Public Media's Israel Hale is joined by Dell Tech President Mark Brainerd to learn more about the new dual role for the Williams House and how it will serve the surrounding community in Millsboro.
So I guess one of my first questions would be the work that went into putting together the museum and it's also doubles as a conference center. What can you tell me more about that?
Sure. The John and Elsie Williams Conference Center and Museum really dates back to the original donation that the family made to Delaware Tech probably 20 some years ago. Senator Williams served in the United States Senate from 1947 until 1970. He lived in Millsboro, and obviously his career started first as a member of the Millsboro Town Council, but then he ran for the United States Senate. And he really established a national reputation. In fact, he was known as the conscience of the Senate. Another way that his colleagues used to refer to him was Honest John. He really developed a reputation throughout his career as taking on corruption, you know, really encouraging public service with a sense of integrity and honesty and things like that. He was a private businessman before entering public service. So he had a pro-business, very fiscal, conservative approach to government. But when he passed, his daughter, Blanche Baker, donated the family home to Delaware Tech with the purpose of using that property as a conference center, a meeting place, but also as a way to honor Senator Williams, his career, and his wife Elsie's service in supporting him as well. So the college had been struggling for a number of years to find a way to utilize that property. And while the home was large for its time and was very beautiful, it sat on a prominent corner in Millsboro, the rooms were such that it was very limiting for large meetings and conferences, if you will. And about 10 or 12 years ago, we approached Blanche Baker and asked her if she would be supportive of us using some of the proceeds from her donation to Delaware Tech to finance an expansion to the property. And that way, an expansion to the property would allow us to have conferences, have guest speakers in, and really celebrate the career and the legacy of Senator Williams and his service to not just the state, but the country. She approved of that, and the college began work on designing a conference center that sits adjacent to the family home. And we also hired a museum-grade consultant to come in and look at the first floor of the home and to see how we could transform that into a high-quality museum space that visitors could access and learn about Senator Williams, learn about Elsie's support of him and her work in Washington, D.C., among the other Senate spouses.
Oh, you mentioned obviously the long and storied career of John Williams, and I do wonder if we can't talk some more about his career and his work as a senator. I've read a couple of outstanding things that are he's credited for in his time as a senator. What are some notable things that he did when he was on the U.S. Senate?
Well, I think what's most notable about him is not just what he did, but how he did it. For those individuals who knew him, they commented that he always brought a sense of willingness to work with everyone. He truly had a nonpartisan approach to trying to solve problems in government. He always looked for solutions. We had a historian who really is the archivist for his official papers, and her comments were really centered upon what he did and how he did it and how he was a convener of individuals from both parties. He many times served as a host in that family home of colleagues from the U.S. Senate. And he spent a lot of time working on relationships. And it seems as if, his neighborly ways in Millsboro and how he interacted with neighbors and family really transferred into his work in public service. And they commented often about how collegial he was, how smart he was, and how experienced he was in business, but also how he had a way of developing relationships that, really allowed him and others to get things done.
It's reported that he had a huge role in rooting out corruption in the IRS. Looks like it says about almost 200, over 200 employees in the Treasury Department were rooted out, exposed of illegal activities as a result of stuff that Senator Williams did. And also he exposed to some corruption from Senate aide Bobby Baker, who was a protege of would-be President Lyndon B. Johnson. But while we talk about him, it's also my understanding too that just as important as Miss Elsie. Can you talk more about her as well?
Sure. But you're very, very spot on when you're talking about his reputation. He had a couple of employees who had the courage really to interact with him and identify ways that the IRS then back in the 40s and 50s. Weren't complying with the spirit or the letter of the law. And he was able to use some of the information he received from those employees to use a Senate position to root that corruption out. Bobby Baker was an interesting figure. He was connected to, a pretty high profile hotel that was built in Ocean City, Maryland. He had access to a lot of decision makers in Washington, D.C. And, at the time, there were questions around, his using those relationships for private gain rather than doing his work for then Majority Leader Senator Lyndon Johnson from Texas. So it was Senator Williams who really focused on Mr. Baker and some of the activities that he was involved in then. And if you look in the museum, you will see covers of then Time Magazine and other national publications that highlighted Senator Williams' work in that area. And, you know, he was known for a very quiet, very strong demeanor, but he was somebody that everyone knew once he, you know, got an issue and he, you know, put his arms around it. He wasn't going to let go until he resolved what the issue was and identified a solution to it. So he could be very tough to deal with. As I said, his reputation was that of being very bipartisan in his approach to policymaking and very collegial. But once he got a hold of an issue, he was going to see it through to the conclusion, much to the frustration of some colleagues, including a future president. Mrs. Williams was well known and highly respected for her ability to develop social connections in Washington, D.C., and the senator always viewed her as a partner in developing those relationships and really enhancing those relationships as a host and hostess in Millsboro back here in Delaware. They were telling stories last week about hosting then Senator Richard Nixon, who was also a future U.S. president. He was very close to President Eisenhower, was well known for his early endorsement and support of President Eisenhower's candidacy. He campaigned for him. He even got his family members involved in the campaign as well. So I think what I'm hearing from some of the historians and family members who referred to that time, they were very much a partnership. That's why it was important to the family that this museum and conference center be named the John N. L.C. Williams Conference Center and Museum. They were very much partners in his work in public service.
While you're talking about that too, the community aspect, can you talk about how this will be of service to the surrounding community, especially with that conference area? How can the community sort of interact with this museum outside of visiting it for a learning opportunity?
This conference center has a lot of state-of-the-art technology that can be used for remote access. So we may have a guest speaker come in and talk about the legacy of Senator Williams, or we might have someone come in remotely from Washington, D.C. to talk about, you know, fiscal policy or economic policy or what we can do to, you know, support the national economic efforts that some of the experts in Washington, D.C. might be able to offer. And we were able to organize a Friends of the Williams House that will be charged with the responsibility of coming up with programs and conferences and guest speakers and that sort of thing. So the ribbon cutting last week really was the mark of opening that space to the public and really just trying to generate some recognition for the property, how it's been transformed, and really to let the community know that they should be looking for programs that will be held there beginning in early 2026.
Thanks to Delaware Tech President Mark Brainerd and our Israel Hale for showing us why history matters this week. One note, Blanche Baker was able to tour the finished renovated home before her death in March 2024 at the age of 100. And that's all we have time for on this edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. You can also sign up for our weekly newsletter there by clicking newsletters at the top of the page. And remember, The Green is also available via podcast at our website, as well as Apple Podcasts, YouTube, and the NPR and Delaware Public Media apps. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page or by emailing us at thegreen@DelawarePublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make this week's show possible, contributors Eileen Dalabrida and John Hurdle, and Delaware Public Media's Israel Hale and Martin Matheny. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Bernsing. Thanks for joining us this week. The Green takes a break next week for the Thanksgiving holiday, so we'll see you again in 2 weeks here on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a first state of mind.